Big Mac, Chicken McNuggets, no, Big Mac and Quarter Pounder with cheese, or Filet-O-Fish. You'd be doing the same thing if you were at McDonald's, because you can choose not just one, but two of your favorites for just $6. Tasty Big Mac, crispy 10-piece Chicken McNuggets, juicy Quarter Pounder with cheese, or savory Filet-O-Fish. Enjoy two of your all-time favorites for just $6, if you can decide on the two. Prices and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
And you are listening to Talk CXO Life, where we get to you stories of business leaders inspiring balance and celebrating life. In this edition, we have with us the erudite and calm Tirupati Karthik, CEO at Napier Healthcare Solutions. Karthik is a turnaround specialist, an erstwhile entrepreneur, a management leader with over two decades of experience in Singapore's IT industry, having worked with companies such as HP and SAP, and nearly a decade experience in healthcare as well. Karthik is also a level 1 WSF certified squash coach, has been an avid runner and squash player, practices yoga and meditation, and is an active advocate for dementia care. In this first part of the conversation, we introduce you to Karthik and let you into his world, comprising key personal and professional milestones, his childhood, briefly touching upon his current interests, his views on success, and finding that elusive happiness. We have also the bonus, of course, CXO fun facts session right at the end. So ready for it? Pay attention, guys, for this one is packed with pearls of wisdom. Happy listening. Hi, Karthik.
Hi,
welcome
Sunaina.
To Talk CXO Life.
Thank you.
How would you describe yourself?
In what way?
As who's a Tirupati Karthik? If you were to introduce, perhaps, yourself.
If I were to introduce like someone, I would say I am stable. I mostly deliver what I say. I'm dependable. Not mercurial, not disruptive, not flashy.
Right.
But someone that you can work with, someone that you can depend on, someone who will look at everything, make sure all the details are right for most parts. Because I have not been perfect, so I can't say I've been right all the time. So for most parts, I have tried to do the best that I can.
And your work speaks for itself.
I think it is.
You've led some of the best companies. What would you say were the biggest turning points of your life?
Professionally, I think I tasted success very early on in my career.
And How young were you?
I was maybe 30 years.
That's young.
I'd made the money that I wanted.
You had founded a company, right?
No, that was about 4 years thereafter.
Okay.
But what happened from the tasting of that success? And immediately thereafter, I was working for this large organization, which right. today is even larger than it was in those years. And I had a lot of people coming to me in those days. We had partners of the big four firm talking right. to me, and you know, the industry leaders all talking to me. And I was very well known in the industry. But the moment I left that organization, I realized no one actually, you know, bothered beyond a point.
Mm.
All the people who were calling me twice, thrice a day, mm. would not even return calls when I needed their help. So it kind of gave me a very different perspective about what life is. And most people go through their professional career thinking their positional prominence is who they are.
Right.
And then it made me realize for a period of about 2 to 3 years that is not what it was. And then when I set up my own venture and I became an entrepreneur, I realized that the people that stood by me, those handful of them, and thereafter everyone who spoke to me was someone that was my real wealth.
Right.
They were the people that depended on me and they didn't depend on the organization I was working for. I think that was a huge turning point to believe that, you know, what you are, you know, you have to count your real friends
right.
from your acquaintances. And I think that was a turning point in my life.
a difficult lesson, but I think nevertheless we should be grateful to get it so early.
I would wish that everyone gets this lesson sooner than later, because there is nothing worse than someone going through their life and coming into their 40s and late 40s when you need the strength of that network the most.
Right.
And you realize that it wasn't in the first place. I had a friend recently who went through that very hard. But suddenly 6 months later, he's a very different person altogether.
Right.
He's a lot more approachable, a lot more friendly. He is a lot less judgmental about others, the failures and their accomplishments,
right,
including his own. And I think that's something that people must realize sooner the better.
Right. I think our lessons seek us in a way.
Yeah.
At a particular juncture, when we need to kind of really learn it.
You have to learn it. You should pray for getting it sooner than later.
So apart from that, were there any other turning points, milestones of your life, which perhaps shaped you?
Professionally, I think my first venture was an eye-opener in many ways. Whatever I did, life taught me at the point of death. So the thing was, either you do this or... When I say point of death, I meant it was more as a metaphor, right? Either the business dies or you got to do this now. You learn a lot of things that you would otherwise not learn. Being venture of your own, they say you are your own boss, you can do what you want. Let me tell you, that is the farthest from the truth. When you are your own boss,
right,
you never get a chance to do what you want, because you always feel that responsibility of the others. You got to do it for the others first before you do it for yourself. And on the 20th of every month, I used to have butterflies in my stomach because the payroll was coming up. I never had money enough. So I was eternally grateful for those few months when there was cash flow. But then on the other time when there was no cash flow, the first thing that comes is, can I give up my salary? And you do that once, you do that twice, and you do that a few times. And then you realize that there is you at the back of everything else. So that makes you a very different person than what you come up to be. And then your decision making when you get back to normal course of life is very different than that.
Since you've been at a leadership role across so many prominent companies, also you founded a company, how different was it? Of course, it's very different. But in terms of changing you and your perspective, and how did you draw from each other?
I think at the end of the day, the biggest lesson one gets from all of that is you are responsible for yourself and your actions. Unless and until that insight doesn't strike you, you'll be forever lost. Not being able to see that your action caused it. When you look at a mirror, if you don't see your face, something is wrong. You can't look at the mirror and lie to yourself. The ability not to lie to yourself, the ability to suspect yourself first before suspecting the other, is the biggest learning you'll get out of all of this. Was that something that I did wrong is the first question I ask myself most of the time, then saying that he did wrong. And that's a learning that one needs to get always. And you can read books. It's like someone very interestingly a few days ago told me, I can read many books on swimming, but I will eventually learn swimming only when I get into the water. You have to get into the water. You have to get into the pool to learn.
After your founding your venture and moving on again to other companies, how do you think it was there a drastic shift in terms of your decision-making skills, or was it, how did it extend to that?
So very interestingly, when my venture folded up thanks to the financial crisis of 2008, and I was left with a lot of debts, nearing bankruptcy and all of that. But thankfully, I got a job in this large organization. And two things stand out. One was I was chosen as a part of the ELT, or what they call as the executive leadership team. And the consultant that came in, the HR consultant, made me take a test. And they said, your speed of decision making is amazing.
Right.
And I didn't want to tell him that it is amazing, not because of anything else, but because of the last 8 to 9 years where there is a split second where you have to make a decision or no decision. And I think that was one. And the second thing was, which my boss, who was the executive director at that point in time, he really appreciated, was we had to start a business with someone. there was no service offering that we had. And yet what I did was I created the service offering.
Mm.
They said we don't have ability to staff it and create, you know, deliver it.
Mm.
So I said, never mind, I will also find a way to deliver it. So I created an opportunity, I created the service offering, I created the delivery capability, I collected the money, and in the whole organization, which was in those days $120 billion, my operating profit was the highest.
Wow.
Sorry, 120 was the parent company. Mm. We were 1.6 billion.
Okay.
So my operating profit was, I think, some 45%, and the company operating profit was 17 or 18%.
Wow, okay.
So when you go in from that kind of a structure to a different structure, the results are astounding.
Mm.
And I don't think I did anything great or out of the world, but the fact is that you think differently. Your mind thinks differently. The rest of the people didn't think differently. And that's what happened. But it's very easy for it to happen the other way around, which is you're so now used to having this ability to make decisions all on your own, and you are in a corporate structure where you get stifled because the decision making is not fast enough, and then you leave.
You leave it.
And in my case, my first impulse was to make it happen. I made it happen. And that got me sufficient equity in the organization to put some of my ideas into practice and things like that. But it didn't happen very easily all the time.
You took ownership and onus.
But a lot of people come back into corporate hierarchy and they say, this is too hard. So I think it's both ways. It could cut both ways. Eventually, I did leave after about 3 years.
Mm.
But, you know, it cuts both ways. That's what I'm saying. That's why people like someone who's been in a startup. But they also don't like someone because that someone is very disruptive. If they see that people are not doing it, they will take the accountability. They'll go ahead and do it. And then you're probably in that process flouted all organizational norms and governance. And it's not a good thing. So it's both ways.
They say that if you have to keep your childhood as a reference point, you know, to understanding yourself, your perspectives that have been formed so far, you as a person today, how would you say it has been? So who influenced you, and how were those days, and what gave you the most joy as a child?
My schooling was very carefree. In those days, I studied in a school in Delhi where my fees was, it was a government school, 38 paisa per month. I think I mentioned that as well.
Yeah.
The biggest thing that some of our teachers told us is you should ask questions. You ask questions, two things happen. You learn, but because of this, few others will also learn. And I think they instilled in us a spirit of inquiry.
Mm.
And that's in many ways defining theme in life all the time. If you are not studying in a school where the teachers encourage you to ask all kinds of silly, stupid questions, you will never grow up to become someone in life who can think outside the box, who can even think for that matter. If all that your teachers are doing is, you know, you go and cram this and you get, you know, 90 or 95 or whatever. And I do not know, I still do not know why, but I never felt pressured in my schooling time to produce good results. My brother was the best in the house, so he checked all the boxes.
Okay.
By the time by the time I came in, I was not the first grandson or grandchild, so everyone had lost interest in me, and my parents, I don't think, could put too much pressure on me. And then my sister came in; she was the last one in the house, so she got all the attention. So in many ways, I got left out, and in some ways, it was good. No one bothered about me, so I was able to do everything the way I wanted, and there was not much expectation of what I should turn out to be. You know, because of some of those teachers, what I did was I spent a lot of time in the classroom getting everything that was said so that I don't have to go back and study.
That's
not. So in some ways, I was employing a, what do you call it, a short circuit or a, you know, shortcut to something. But I always thought if I did that well and I did everything that was needed, then I don't have to, like the others, go back and doing something. I think those were some of the defining things that have stuck on.
It's fascinating. You said that you studied in a government school, considering the way in the position that you hold now in a country like Singapore, especially now, because, you know, if you look at the way the educational landscape is also changing in the metros in India, it's more commercialized. You have big, big schools come up. But this is the basic thing, isn't it? The teacher, first of all, the most primary person who's driving this, and the whole spirit of inquiry,
correct,
which needs to be instilled right since childhood. Correct. I think that is the basic.
You have to be inquisitive about everything. A child who doesn't ask questions, I would worry about. Your child or a child or any child must ask questions, no matter how silly and stupid you are. And even if that says, teacher, why is it that you said this today that I shouldn't do, but you're yourself doing it? And that also keeps the system honest.
Right.
You can't expect to be a role model that doesn't, you know, do what you said yourself.
What gave you the most joy as when you were a child? Is
what gave me most joy was, I think I could tell a story. I could write a story.
Oh, okay.
And
when did you begin this writing stories?
I think I must have written my earliest story probably when I was in grade 8,
okay.
7 or 8.
Mm-hmm.
Was about 12-13 years.
Mm-hmm. You remember what it was about?
I remember it had an unusual ending.
Right.
So I'm still looking for I'm still looking for that book of stories that I used to write.
So now coming back to your current, you know, where you invest yourself outside your work, certain passions of your life, squash, for example. How did you take to squash, actually? How did you start considering the Indian obsession with cricket?
I used to play cricket. But I think we started squash because one of my closest friends, a Bihari guy, he introduced me to squash. And he said, well, squash, you just have to run. So the first part of it I used to like was, just run. You just run happily wherever the ball was in the court. And you try to whack it as hard as you can. But it gave you a strange sense of, when you play squash, right, it gives you, it liberates you from everything else. You've given your best and you've kind of gone in and, you know, run as hard as you can and, you know, hit it as well as you could. So I think those were some of the things, and that got me interested in squash. I played my first game of squash maybe in 95 maybe.
What's one memorable incident as a squash coach?
So I thought there was this kid who I was being very harsh on. You know, you see some kids, they don't try and they don't do all that. And then I was talking to their parent. They said, oh, she absolutely loves coming to your class. But then she's also dreading the fact that what have I not done previously that would upset the coach. I'd like to look at it as a positive thing, because I always tell people squash and coaching is not about the game itself. My kids have gotten a lot more out of squash.
Okay.
Than the game itself. Both my kids play squash. My daughter now plays for the university, and, you know, my son also plays for the club and all of that. But when they play, I know that a lot of values that they got came from the coaches.
Right.
And that's why I support someone like an ultimate squasher, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because when you're teaching 100, 120 kids on a monthly or a weekly basis, you're actually not only imparting them the skill for the sport, but you're also telling them hard work pays.
Right.
You're telling them if you lose, don't give up. Keep coming back at it. Those are some of the values that, you know, no teacher in the class beyond a point can instill, whereas a sport can bring you that. That's why a sport is as much a part of your education than your education itself. So it has to be all-rounded.
Sure.
You can't be just... You have to have that feeling, you know, I shouldn't give up. At what point do I give up? That's what sport is all about, and that's something that whenever you get a kid who comes back and says, ah, well, he's stern, but I like him. And I used to have teachers like that, people who were stern, but you always ended up liking them because if you mean well for a kid, it'll always come through. The kid will be able to see. It's that empathy between two individuals that happens. When you know that someone is your well-wisher and the external demeanor is not something that is the real personality.
Right. So I'll make my son listen to this.
Hopefully
he gets it.
How old is he?
He's just 7.
early, but you should put him under a coach in some sport or the other.
Right. He's begun this whole coaching thing, and he'll be like, you know, the coach is very strict. So I'm like, you know, he's strict for a reason.
Yeah.
You know, So how to get that to a child, you know, to make them
understand.
But
that's the job of the coach. Yeah. So one of the things I always tell people is, my job as a coach is not to teach. My job as a coach or as a teacher is to make sure
that love in them.
The kid comes back for the next class.
Right.
If the kid doesn't come back to the next class, you don't exist as a coach. It's as simple as that.
Right.
So what you do, one thing that I do follow is in every, even when I was teaching, one of the things I follow is when I have done a whole lesson, the last 10 minutes you review the lesson and you ask questions from the various kids to understand whether they got it or not.
Mm-hmm.
But I would pick one of the guys who's trying very hard and give him an easy question and say, wow, you got it. And you know, you sat through 50 minutes of a class,
right.
But what you remember is the teacher praised you for getting it right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So similarly, at the end of every squash lesson, you want to give them something that they're good at doing. So if a kid is good at, you know, forehand drive, I would get them to do that at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Or I would give them a backhand drive, depending on whatever they like,
mm-hmm.
whatever they want to do. Something that leaves you with a high in a class. That is the role of a teacher, to bring the kid back the next time so that you still have a chance of doing
mm-hmm.
something with the kid. You don't, then there is no kid and you're not a teacher anymore. You're not a coach anymore. You're a coach only because there is a kid in the room. You're not a coach because there is no kid in the room.
You're also mentoring aspiring innovators in a way you spend time. So how difficult is it to assume that kind of responsibility? And do you get to relive your days as a founder yourself?
Not very difficult. A lot of people that do come to you, come to you because they are looking for that insight. So I think as a coach, or again, it's as a coach, right?
Exactly.
You're a business coach in this case, you're not a squash coach.
Mm.
But as a coach, what you need to do is, you need to find out what is it that they really need.
Mm.
So one of the things that I feel quite fortunate about is being an engineer, a skill that we all learn is how to frame a problem. An engineer's talent does not lie in solving a problem.
Mm.
The engineer's talent lies in how you frame a problem. If I frame the problem of someone suffering from fever as he's suffering from fever, then you're only going to be administering more and more paracetamol.
Right.
But that's not the problem.
Mm.
The problem is something different.
Okay.
So you have to get to the problem and frame the problem in such a way that the solution is something that you can point out. At the end of the day, you're also mindful of the fact that they have to act on the solution.
Mm.
They have to take your advice. So you also want to be giving advice only to those that can actually take that advice and do something about it.
Mm.
Many a times you give them advice, two or three times you tell them, you sit with them, and then you realize your wavelengths do not match.
Mm.
They do not see this as a problem. It's best to disengage.
Right.
So one part of mentorship is also when you disengage. Not out of spite, because
right.
they didn't take your advice, but because the solutions and the problems you see are not shared by them. So what's the point of working if you're not aligned to the same object? The disengagement is equally important.
Mm.
It's not just the engagement alone. You don't want to become an annoyance and a nuisance to them just because they've agreed that you are a mentor or whatever.
Are there some striking moments you've had with anything that has left an impact on your that you also got to learn from?
No, I think all the time when you're teaching, coaching, mentoring people all the time, I always say this, I become a better person. You know, my daughter never fails to remind me that I became a father only after she was born, right? So she says, you are not an appa before I was born. So, you know, don't think too highly of yourself. So I also remember that. And the thing is, you have to also be open to those learning experiences. In that kind of a setting, you learn how to teach them better. You learn how to spot different people better. The role is for you to bring the best out of them, not for you to criticize them or for them to become a replica of what you are or what you want
to
be.
That's very important.
And everyone will flourish in their own way, just like the way I probably never turned out the way my teachers or my parents dreamt of me. I have done things that no one ever thought I might do or, you know, I will ever get to do.
Right.
It's very different. You have to be open to learning from them all the time. You have to you have to grant yourself the fact that you are not perfect. You are forever a student, you are forever a teacher.
Okay, right. Now, you like to write. Like you said, that's something that you've always, even when you're young, you began writing. And you still manage, whenever you get the time, you do manage to pen some posts on LinkedIn. One of the ones that I liked reading was happiness that you had mentioned. You know, how happiness seems elusive in this society around you when you see people living with material abundance, which you think would make them happy because they can get whatever they want, but still they aren't. They just want more and more and more and more, and that's why it seems so elusive. So according to you, how does one handle that kind of paradox, wherein if you go to see any corporate life or that we've been engineered to work for success, the definition of success is that you get out, put yourself up, push all your limits, you know, strive to get this, that bungalow, the car, what? The vacations. And at the same time, you're saying that, you know, you've got to get back, you've got to be grounded. How does one handle that kind of a paradox?
I think couple of things, right? One is the way we define happiness, I feel, is in itself flawed.
Mm-hmm.
Happiness ought not be defined as that moment of exaltation. People always say, he's so happy because he's smiling, jumping up and down.
Mm-hmm.
But how often do you do that in your life?
Mm.
How often does that happen to you? Will you be happy every time you close a $1 million deal?
Mm.
How many $1 million deals do you close a year?
Close.
How many, you know, bungalows can you buy? And the worst thing about human tendency is this, right? If I desire a thing and I get it, I lose interest in it after that. I always want more of it. Now, if you for a moment step back, the way I just described happiness, this is the same way you would describe alcoholism or drug abuse. Because once you have a little bit of alcohol, if you drink every day one peg, it doesn't, after a few days, that one peg doesn't affect you anymore.
Right.
You want two. Then two doesn't help, and then you want three. And then very quickly, if you continue down that path, you actually become an alcoholic. You become a drug abuser. Just that in this case, you are looking for happiness all the time. And the way you have defined happiness is, I want to be in that exalted state of ecstatic happiness.
Right.
Doesn't happen.
Right.
But if you for a moment think that happiness can, just put yourself when you are happy. What is it that happens to you when you are happy? A lot of things happen. But one thing certainly that doesn't happen to you is you don't feel any sadness. I would seldom find someone who's so happy that at the same time they're equally sad. It doesn't happen. Even someone who's going through tough mental conditions of depressions, when they're happy, they're really happy. So what if you defined happiness as a state where sadness does not exist? If sadness does not exist and that is happiness, suddenly you'll find yourself happy in everyday situation, everyday circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
You'll feel happy because, not because your wife praised you, but because your wife didn't scold you. You think, oh my God, today I should be happy. Because she didn't. And now what it does is, it also brings down your expectations.
Mm.
It brings down your expectations of people. It brings down your expectation to be praised all the time, to be seen as a hero all the time. And then you start to think, okay, I am indeed happy because I'm not sad. And then you get used to it.
Mm.
And then once in a while something super happy makes you happy. Then you recognize that that is a state of happiness.
Mm.
But that is not my natural state. Because that never was a natural state in the first place to begin with. So this is what happens when you are in corporate life. You want to do more and more. But if you reconcile yourself to the fact that you want to do more and more, and that's not because you want more money, you find that there is a need for you to achieve bigger things, that's a good way to motivate yourself. But the moment you make that and you tie it up with a connection to money, the whole edifice crumbles.
Mm.
You will never be happy. And someone was, I was watching an interview yesterday of a Malaysian writer, I forget his name, Tyson Ow or something like that. And he said, no writer is in the profession because they think it's the best profession to make money. Right? Writers are there because they like to express themselves.
Mm.
That's what they like to do. That's the passion that they are in. And that's what you should be in.
Mm.
Why are you in a dead-end job that doesn't make you happy and, you know, gives you money, but that money doesn't make you happy? Isn't that irreconcilable? I'm doing what I'm supposed to do, getting what I'm getting, yet I'm not happy. So the very definition of happiness needs to change. That's one one big takeaway for me.
What's your definition of success?
I actually don't like any success.
You don't like success?
There is nothing called success. There is nothing called failure. Success exists because of failure. Do we realize that? If there was no such thing called failure,
there wouldn't be
a success. So what it tells you is success and failures are two aspects of the same thing. It's like telling me I want to pick up one end of the stick without wanting the other end. Mm. Or I want one side of the coin without taking the other. If you don't recognize that as being two sides of the same thing, failure should affect you equally as success should. If I'm happy with success, I should also be happy with failure because it's taught me something. Which means I'm probably moving on to a more spiritual way of talking, which is you cannot let success and failure affect you differently. If both are same sides of this coin, they should affect you equally. And for you to be able to recognize that this is as important as that. Very few people will learn from a success, but everyone will learn from a failure. Yeah. I can ask you, what was the last time that you were really happy? Mm. And maybe you'll remember one or two incidents. Mm. But if I asked you how many times you failed in life, I can bet you, you will list out every one of them. But do you realize they were far and few between as compared to the number of times you were happy with joy? So this whole concept of happiness is overrated. You are rating it and putting it at a pedestal at such a level that you will be able to reach it only once in a while. You don't climb Mount Everest every day.
True.
Why should you be so ecstatically happy every day? Yet we choose to define it that way. That is the problem.
Now looking back at your journey, what would you say what amazes you most about yourself, your journey?
What amazes me is I'm here where I am.
You can't
never
believe it?
Never in the wildest dreams that I ever think I would be here.
Did you hope for it?
No.
You didn't even hope for it?
I didn't even hope for it. Mm. So all I have done, I think, in my entire life is I've tried to do the best I can and be the least disappointed with the results. I think, again, it's my strange way of framing happiness. Mm. If I see an outcome and I'm not saddened by it, I'm happy. So when in my 10th grade I got a distinction, I wasn't sad by it because someone expected me to get 90s or whatever it is. I said 75 is not bad, right? And in those days, I remember in Delhi, there's not everyone who got a 75. Mm. So there were a handful of you. So I thought, doesn't sound bad. Similarly, you got through engineering with decent academic performance. Mm. I said, that wasn't bad. You get a job in the campus. Well, you got a job, so that's not so bad. I didn't need a job that paid me the highest or made me the best in the world or, you know, go to the best universities in the world. I got through a university, which is not a bad university in the first place. Mm. So that's not too bad. So I think my success in life has been because I've always gotten used to doing the best I could with my limited talent and not feeling saddened or disappointed with the outcome. As long as I felt what I could do, I have done the best. I think I'm okay. So, did I expect to be where I am? I didn't. But if you had no expectations of yourself, everything would seem a miracle. You know, the miracle that someone even agreed to marry me shocked me. The miracle that someone said, let's have a family, shocked me. The fact that the kids grew up and they are doing what they are doing shocked me. So, in a pleasant kind of a way, but that's because that's not what you expect. If you do not expect anything, but you do what you're supposed to do to the best of your abilities, I think in the long run, it will even out. That's what the investment bank.
Right?
Yeah, the investment bankers also say the same thing. They say, invest in the stock for the long term.
Right.
There will be ups and downs every day. Don't exit every time there is a down. Don't invest every time the market is going up. If you stay focused over a period of 10, 20, 30 years, you will return a higher number on your investment than the average. And you should be happy with it.
So we've almost reached the conclusion.
Okay.
Now, the last question that we ask everybody is, what are you committed to keep alive in you?
I want to keep doing something meaningful, not selfish, and something that keeps me engaged with the people around me. At the end of the day, it's not what I am, but it is what the society is. Still, I'm here on this planet. You want to be a part of that society. You don't. I would be very hurt if someone told me this guy destroyed my life, or this guy, he spoiled it all for us, or he didn't do what he could have done. I don't want to be under obligation to anybody. On the other hand, you would want to measure yourself by saying, am I gifted enough to give to people? And that's when you feel that you have done something, not the other way.
We wish you the very best. And we Thank hope you. That you keep enriching the lives of people around you.
In my
and
own small way.
In your own small way, in your own small world that you yes. like to construct around yes. yourself. Thank you yes. so much for your time.
Thanks Karthik. So much. And I really enjoyed talking
Thank
to you.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Welcome to CXO Fun Facts.
Hi.
So we're going to ask you a set of rather funny, interesting questions.
Mm-hmm.
Are you up for it?
Yes, already.
Okay, tell me one thing about that you love about India and one about Singapore.
I think India is all about creativity.
Okay.
I wouldn't want to call it jugaad, but I think it is just creativity. The ability to be resilient under all circumstances, I think that defines India. Singapore, on the other hand, is all about how do I think of tomorrow. I think as a country, we have always been like that because we started with nothing. When
right.
we got independence, we had very few people and even the following morning was in doubt. So the whole psyche of Singapore and Singaporeans is about how do I, preserve my future? How do I do it in the best possible manner, in the most objective manner? So our entire national narratives, our policy making, the way people think here is about safeguarding the future. So in many ways, it's very ennobling in the sense that you're not worried about yourself, but about your future generation.
Mm-hmm.
How do I take care of them and things like that? Quite direct contrast to each other.
Right.
One is very efficient, very clinical. The other is very chaotic and very creative.
Right.
Both have their own places. So in many ways, I think I relish the best of both worlds.
Lucky you. Okay, now what's your favorite color? This is the most cliche question.
let me see. I would think I started off with blue somewhere.
Oh,
and typical blue. Boyish blue.
Yeah.
And I think off late I have experimented a lot with pink. So
okay.
I think I'm now very comfortable with pink as well. But very strangely, I don't relish loud colors, the oranges and the greens and all of those. My safest choice is a white, of course.
Nice. One color that you think represents you?
I would say it's blue.
Blue?
Blue or not a variation of blue, which is a turquoise.
Okay. In the sense of why?
Calm.
Calmness. Okay.
It's just calm.
All right. How do you maintain that? What's the secret to that?
I think calmness, and this is also about happiness, right? All these don't come from outside. They come from inside. So you have to find that spot inside you that lets you be calm all the time, regardless of what it is.
Mm-hmm.
It's not easy, but it's something certainly worth fighting for. How do you maintain that composure, that calmness?
Right.
So I think maybe turquoise is calm in my mind because that's the color of the sea. For most parts, when it is calm, that's azure and
right.
turquoise and all
you
of
like
that.
You like the sea?
I like watching the sea.
Watching
I don't.
The
I
sea,
hate
right?
the thought of being in the water that
oh,
is salty. I like only fresh water.
Okay. So, the sea. So what is your favorite holiday destination? Do you seek the mountains, the beaches, something of that sort? Or you just, is it on the spur of the moment?
I think it's spur of the moment and I want to be in a place where I can be myself. For me, holidays is just...
So is there a particular place which brings out that, draws you out?
There are some places more spiritual. So
okay.
if they're very quiet, it could be a forest or it
mm-hmm.
could be... One of the best things I enjoyed, and we did this three times in a row, not 3 years, was we went, me and a couple of my friends, we went to the Mahakumbh. We did Haridwar, we did Allahabad. And I think in many ways, there is a certain calmness there.
There's an energy as well.
There is an energy and a certain calmness which you do not find even if you go into the middle of a forest, for example.
It's very scenic also, and you have this...
The whole atmosphere, whole... You can imbibe a lot from there. So that's very interesting.
What's your favorite cuisine?
My favorite cuisine would be Tamil food.
Tamil food, okay. No,
the vegetarian. All vegetarian. I would say it's mother's food.
How have you managed to survive here? All
well, there is home, there is my wife, and there are... So the food is there. But I think that's
you mentioned your mother's food. You didn't mention you're going to get into trouble.
you got to be politically right. But there is that food. That food is very uncomplicated, very simple. You don't have to think twice about what do I want to eat or, you know, all of that. So something that's... You could just be on a, you know, sambar, rasam and some amount of vegetable kind of a thing. Every South Indian needs curds at the end. So you finish all of those, then you're done.
Right. So your comfort food would be rice, sambar, curd.
Yeah, something like that you can just eat. So that's the comfort food. I don't need fanciful food. I do love tasting all kind of food. So as a principle, whenever I am on travel, and I travel fairly quite a lot actually. So when I travel, I always try to eat the food of that country.
Nice.
I've told my guys, don't take me to Chinese when I am in Saudi Arabia, for example. It doesn't make any sense. Right. It doesn't make any sense for me to be sitting in a Indian restaurant in Saudi Arabia, for example. So that's kind of what I do. I'm very adventurous with food.
That's good, because not many people are also.
So I was a vegetarian once upon a time for the first 23 years of my life.
Right.
And now I'm making up for lost time.
Okay. So what's the most the delicious non-vegetarian food that you tried? And you're like, oh my God, I missed this for so long. I can't believe it.
I think it has to be...
Where did that begin?
I think it began in Singapore. When I came here those many years ago, there wasn't, you know, as a bachelor, so you don't cook beyond a point at home. So when you have to eat outside, you got to get used to whatever food is there. So I did, you know, it was more by way of force. And probably that also explains why my comfort food isn't anything non-vegetarian. So I do eat non-vegetarian, but my default is veg. But having said that, some of the non-vegetarian food that I really like, I like Turkish cuisine.
Okay.
Really very nice. Even the Middle Eastern cuisine is very nice. Amongst the Indian ones, I would say it's more the Goanese and also very, not strangely, but also Bihari food.
Okay.
The Bihari food is one of the favorites I like.
Okay. Now, what are some of your favorite things? If you would, you know, these are a few of my favorite things. What would they be?
What I would like to do? Read books. Well, I would want to run. I can continue running. That doesn't happen that much. But those are probably two things I would like to do.
My favorite things. So great. One book that you would recommend?
One is called The Autobiography of a Yogi.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
By Paramahansa Yogananda. I think that's a good one. Then there is one more which Gurcharan Das wrote, The Difficulty of Being Good.
Okay. What are the top three things that would figure in your wish list, in your bucket list, if you have one?
My bucket list... it's probably too old at this age to be thinking of that, but what I do is, what I want to do is, I want to be a backpacker and just be myself for maybe a few months altogether.
That's good.
Just be, like I said, it's going back to being yourself, and you know, maybe my wife and I, we just go out for a few months and do whatever we want to do. A lot of places I would like to see without the pressure of I got to get back on a flight on a Saturday or a Sunday and get back to office on a Monday. You just want to explore a place. I think that's probably what is my bucket list.
I wish you get to that sooner.
I want to do that.
Right. Now, coming to squash, okay? Who's your favorite squash player?
I would say El Shorbagi. I think he's currently one of the top players. He plays a very good brand of squash very aggressive as well, mm-hmm. very deceptive as well. And mm-hmm. I think in general, Egypt has a lot of talent that they have produced in the last few years.
And how is it so that Egypt is doing this?
I would like to know. I don't know what they do, but they do produce very good squash players.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's just like the way Pakistan used to be once upon a time. Mm. When they were producing all the Khans, the Janshirs and the Jahangir Khans and all of that. That was, I think every country goes through that. There's a golden period of a sport in a country. And somehow that is the time when everything comes together. West Indians had that with cricket.
Right, true.
I think India is going through that golden age right now in cricket.
Mm-hmm.
Not that nothing goes wrong, but very few things go wrong. And I think that's kind of what happens in every sport in every country.
It is one of the richest. It's the richest, in fact, cricketing.
Today, India is the richest, But not globally. Globally, I would still think, I think soccer is the number one, followed by golf.
Right. No, within the cricketing.
India is the most.
Right. So they better be doing something.
So I think that there is also that innovation that comes in. There is also the marketing that comes in. The T20s that came in. And before that, the one days that came in. So as long as the sport constantly, and that is not true of sport, it is true of anything in life.
True.
As long as you constantly reinvent yourself, it becomes a very different thing. And you have to go past what Malcolm Gladwell said as the tipping point. You have to reach the tipping point and then go past that. After that, the world is very different.
Is there a thing, it's just a funny question. But is there a thing that you like to chase, but also kind of run away from?
What money.
You run away from that?
I want to run away from money. In fact, money is
Money is not evil.
You know, the strange thing about money is it's like a drug. You can never have enough of it. You don't know when to stop. In fact, I wrote in one of my blogs on happiness. There was a time when in Singapore I was making $2,700 a month. And that equates to something like, $34,000, $35,000 a year and, all of that. And I used to think, if I could get a job of $100,000 a year, I think that would be
the ultimate,
then I can relax. That came and went. It didn't stop. Today, where we are, there is inflation and all. You factor all of that, but you still come to a point where you realize. In fact, a lot of us would realize today that we made enough money to last our lifetime.
And yet we are at it.
Yet it doesn't feel good enough. So, but in my case, I think I have at least gotten a little better. I don't work for money anymore. I work more for, if you could believe that. I don't want too many people hearing that. I work now more for making something happen. I also realize and understand that, there is an organization of 400 odd people that depends on me to do the right things. You multiply it by their next of kin, that's 400 times 4, which is 1,600 if you take their parents.
True.
So I'm looking at, 2,000 or... So when you think of that as a responsibility, suddenly everything changes. You want to do the right thing. You want to run this organization in the best possible manner. Mm. At the same time, understanding that there are some limitations of yours that prevent you from doing that. So I'm now doing the same thing, but for a different reason. Do I need to chase money? I do. In business, I have to chase money. I have to chase revenue. I have to do the right things.
Mm.
And yet, I have to keep a balance.
A personality you would like to know better?
For me, it would be Lee Kuan Yew.
Okay. Why?
He was a man 50 years ahead of his time. 50 years ahead of his time. I have not, in my life, I have not come across someone who's been such a visionary.
Okay.
I always tell the story. Think of an ant, which supposedly is a two-dimensional organism. It can only see the length and the breadth. We as human beings can see the depth. I can see where the ant is going in a 5-meter long wall, and I know after 10 minutes it will only get to that part. And I'm saying that's foolish because there's a door that's going to close on you and you'll most probably be squished. But the ant doesn't know. But I know. And I can see 10 minutes ahead in the ant's life. Just imagine if there was someone who could see 10 minutes in my life. And here was a man who had the ability to think and connect dots 50, 100 years ahead. And that's something you want to know. How does that man's mind, how does that man's thought, how does his whole thing work. And he was very clear, even when he made decisions that people now are saying is not right or was not right or whatever it is. But at that moment in time, the clarity of thought that he had was amazing. And the clarity of thought comes only when there is a clarity of purpose.
Right.
If you are very clear about what your purpose is, the thought in terms of clarity will be there.
True.
And that's one thing you want to know. Very few individuals like that.
Right. Okay, tell us a couple of lesser known facts about yourself, about Karthik.
On a more personal note, I'm a very quiet person. I'm not as talkative or garrulous or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
In a social gathering, I would probably be the one sitting all by myself.
Okay.
I don't tend to socialize very much. But most people that know me in office and everywhere else think it must be the other way around. Actually, it is not.
Okay.
So my wife complains, you know, you're very friendly whenever you step out, but at home you're all by yourself, and that is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that in many ways is my strength, the ability to spend that quietude with myself. You have to have that. Some people need the world. I actually don't need the world. I can be by myself,
right.
All by myself.
You can
without,
see that world.
I can be just by myself. I don't need anybody. So that's very strange.
No, that's I think one of the biggest strengths that you can have. Thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome.
Right now at Kohl's, take an extra 25% off top active brands, including Under Armour for her. Get Nike shoes for the family, $48.75 and under, and save on Levi's denim for the family. Plus, get limited contact store drive up, and get even more for your wallet with Kohl's Cash. Shop Kohl's and Kohl's.com. 25% off Under Armour ends August 9th. Nike ends August 8th. Levi's sale ends August 30th. Offers and coupons do not apply. Select styles. Some exclusions apply. See store or Kohl's.com for details.